This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Melissa Block. When a young musician from Nigeria came by our studios recently, we started with a pronunciation lesson.
Sheun.
Sheun.
Well, you see, you have to, like, singing it. Sheun.
Sheun.
Yes, good enough for me.
I'm going to go for better than good enough by the end of this interview.
Sheun is spelled S-E-U-N. His last name, Kuti. Sheun Kuti is 25. His father, Fela Kuti, created the sound of Afrobeat with lots of horns and jazz influences. Fela Kuti died of AIDS in 1997. Now Sheun Kuti is leading his father's band, Egypt 80. When he came by our studios, Sheun Kuti was grooving to the American R&B singer Trey Songz on his iPod. He wore a Trey Songz t-shirt and cap and shorts belted way below his hip bones. So his influences are American, but his songs are all about Africa, sharply pointed political songs. In this song, Kuti uses the voice of former Nigerian President Olusegun Obasanjo, bragging about how he made Nigeria better. Sheun Kuti sees things differently.
After his 8 years of office, things are worse than they've ever been. People in my country are poorer than they've ever been. The economy is worse than it has ever been. The only people that things are getting better for are the rich people. You know, the society is now in a strictly rich getting richer, poor getting ultra-poor situation. For every high-rise they build, they create 1,000 hungry families.
And these are some of the things you're singing about in this song, people with no water to drink, nowhere to live.
Well, it's a pity, but it's the same thing we've been saying in Afrobeat for 40 years, still happening to us in Africa.
You mentioned Afrobeat. Afrobeat is the music that your father created and named many, many years ago. I read something where you described Afrobeat as the sound that raised you.
It's true. Afrobeat, you know, I grew up listening to it every day from my mother's womb. My dad took us to all the shows, went on tours with him. He took us on every gig. It was like a part of our life. It was a culture, Afrobeat, you know. Because Afrobeat is more than just music. Afrobeat is a whole movement. It's a philosophical movement. It's a political movement. It's a social movement. But most of all, because that's how it's known all over the world, it's a musical movement.
And how would you describe that sound?
It's the truth. One word. Afrobeat is the truth. That's how you describe it.
Tell me about the song African Problems.
But it's just a song I did because, you know, a lot of fighting is going on in Africa, you know. And a lot of good people are dying in this fight, you know, fighting to solve Africa's problems. So the song is just saying, you know, we could fight all we want, but if we're not fighting for the right causes, if we don't have the right ideology behind what we're fighting for, African problems will always be there, you know. And in that same song, you know, I salute all my brothers that fight really for this future. I must to shout them, make them dig yaram. Ah! I must start to teach the people new mentality, make them appreciate Africa's superiority, make them not seem like something supposed to be. My leaders will put up for this mediocrity, take away our peace and liberty, leave us to live in the pain and poverty. We no understand the government policy, but they take to sell us into second slavery.
Make you happy. You have a line in here, they're selling us into second slavery.
Yeah, of course, that's what we're going through in Africa today. The new kind of slavery, you know, the slavery that is still accepted by the world. Slavery is a very straightforward theory. You work for nothing. If you work somewhere on a particular piece of land and you don't make any money, any kind of future of that land, you're in slavery. In my country, for example, of 150 million, 130 million people or something like that still live on $1 a day. So this remaining 10-20 million that have jobs in these banks that these people put up with our money that they've stolen, these oil companies that are using to launder all their money, they are privileged. So to them, Nigeria is getting better. While behind them on the streets, two people just got shot and killed and robbed of $5. Kids everywhere begging, washing your car on the streets as you drive. You know, but Nigeria is getting better just because they are getting a salary. They're forgetting that we're leaving 130 million people behind in abject poverty.
Your father was beaten, he was imprisoned for singing about the same sorts of issues 20, 30 years ago. You don't seem to be running that same risk. Do you think, is that a sign that things in Nigeria have changed, that you have more freedom to say the things that you're saying right now?
Yeah, but you never heard my father moan about it, though. So obviously they've learned from that brutality is not the way to go. He ain't going to shut a man up by locking him up or beating him up if he believes in what he's saying. Afrobeat is not being attacked physically by beating up the artist anymore. In my country, me and my brother basically are maybe the only Afrobeat bands out there, you know.
In all of Nigeria?
Yeah. Why? Because the government will not support it. It's hard for DJs to play Afrobeat on the radio. A young man in Nigeria that is not making up to $10 a week, how is he going to ever think of starting Afrobeat, start a band, when their government will not support them? Nobody will support them because they are doing what they do, because it's against the government, you know. So it's that kind of thing that we are against. But that is the same reason why I'm happy that my father did not influence Nigerians alone, and my father's message is not local. What he stood for was global, and what we discuss is global issues, and our music is accepted globally. So they could decide to remain in the dark for the rest of their lives, for all I care. You know, they can't stop the movement.
Well, Mr. Kuti, thanks so much for coming in.
Yeah, thank you for having me as well.
I'm going to try your name again. Seyun.
Seyun.
Seyun Kuti.
Wow!
To hear more songs from Seyun Kuti and Egypt 80, check out the music section of npr.org.
What if you had the chance to get inside the heads of a couple of young composers talking shop about their work? NPR's Jackie Lydon had a chance to do just that.
Composers are people most of us are used to encountering, taking a bow on stage, or maybe as marble busts at the library. But recently, I spent some time at the Yaddo Colony for Artists and Writers in Saratoga Springs, New York, and I saw several of these people in T-shirts and shorts. I don't get to meet many composers this informally, and I don't know why anyone would try to be a composer. I mean, I can understand becoming a performer, but composers have a bit of an old-world, gaslight quality for me. And yet, as I discovered, I'm entirely the one who's out of date.
This is my third or fourth work that uses the squeaky toy.
Carl Schimmel is 32, holds advanced degrees from Yale and Duke in music composition, and has had his music performed from Alaska to Japan. He loves to use humor in his work, and does in this piece, played by Tame Moore Sullivan on the alto sax and squeaky toy. It's called As Fast as Possible.
I first used a squeaky toy in a piece called Serving Size Four Bunnies. And it's a title that I took from the nutritional facts information from a box of marshmallow peeps. actually the Easter version, which is bunnies. And that piece really features the squeaky toy in all its various moods that it can project, which most people wouldn't necessarily think of when they think of a squeaky toy as being a sad thing or an angry thing. But you can get all these different sounds just from a squeaky toy, depending in particular on how you score for it with other instruments. You can convey all kinds of moods just with a squeaky toy.
Now, Carl Schimmel is actually quite a serious composer, but he loves a cartoonish quality. He's used balloon pops, he's writing a piece for a whoopee cushion, but it isn't as if he's trying to be a gimmicky guy. He is trying to make his music relevant.
I think that there are a lot of classical musicians out there who might look down on a piece that's so whimsical and silly. At the same time, it's for that very reason that I have an interest in writing these pieces, because there's so few concert works that are just in-your-face ridiculous. And the ones that are often avant-garde as well. And so it becomes difficult sometimes to appreciate the connection to a tradition that can be there, which is important for example, the orchestras, to really catch and capture the attention and imagination of young people in order to maintain their audience sizes.
If Carl's challenge was to make something in-your-face absurd, young Greek composer Kostis Kritsotakis, 34, had another challenge, writing a new concerto for mandolin with a full orchestra. Concertos for mandolin were written in the Baroque period, and never for mandolin and full orchestra. Kostis got the commission in 2001 from the Greek Orchestra of Colors, and he decided to go wild. It took 6 or 7 months for Kostis to write this.
To me, maybe this sounds a little corny, but I see the wind filling the sails of a tempest-tossed ship. I mean, there's storms and waves and a kind of a crashing and surging.
Yes, you see, mandolin is usually associated with more romantic character music, more easygoing. So I wanted to begin with something really wild that would contrast this feeling, this idea we have about mandolin.
Kostis, who teaches in Philadelphia, had his work performed by the Albany Symphony Orchestra this past spring. He says this is a rich time for young composers, in part because the atonality of the avant-garde movements of the 60s and 70s has reached its endpoint. Carl Schimmel agrees.
40, 50 years ago, you wouldn't typically hear a singable tune. And while I don't necessarily write that kind of music, there is certainly a trend, I think, toward reaching out toward the audience and drawing on more traditional and understandable ways of communicating through music.
And so, at the ages of 32 and 34, these young men feel as bold and romantic and full of vigor as the old masters ever did. And they've been writing classical music for decades. Kostis, since he was 14.
My first constructed piece was a piano tarantella. It hasn't been performed in public.
Carl, since he was 12.
The first piece I wrote was called the Little Wakefield Waltz. And Wakefield is the name of the town I grew up in, so I wanted, you know, our town to have a waltz, right?
Actually, once you start to look, they're not so scarce. Young men and women still poring over their musical scores, accepting the challenge of their quirky assignments and writing themselves into the future. For NPR News, I'm Jackie Leiden.
You can see the score for Carl Schimmel's As Fast as Possible, complete with the line for Squeaky Toy, and listen to the full piece at npr.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Melissa Block. Now to summer music. Our critic Meredith Oakes has found a song she thinks is fitting for one theme of the season. That theme, skipping a vacation because of high gas prices or frustrations with the airlines. The song is called How Was California from the group Reckless Kelly. Here's Meredith Oakes.
I will always remember 2008 as the year of the staycation, the notion that staying at home can be substituted for a getaway. I hate the way that word sounds as much as I hate what it means. It's just an excuse for canceling your summer travel plans in the face of sky-high fuel prices, unspeakable airline indignities, and general economic woes. That's why I'm especially grateful for Reckless Kelly's new song about traveling, called How Is California? It's a much better rationalization for not going away than the dreaded staycation. This song by Reckless Kelly skips across the United States to illustrate the point that it's just not worth the trouble to go anywhere this summer. It has the kind of jaded feeling that only someone who spent a lot of time driving around the country could express. But it's more than just a bummed-out anthem for a summer of staying close to home. Singer Willie Braun is hinting at our national malaise. According to him, every city has the blues, even his own hometown of Austin, Texas, a place known for fun. As any itinerant knows, it doesn't matter how far you travel, you will always bring yourself with you. And that's another message in this Reckless Kelly song. People who go on vacation to escape their lives may get to do a new thing or two, but there's no way to leave your troubles behind. All that said, I guess I've resigned myself to spending this summer at home. Good thing I live in one of the most exciting cities in the world. Oh, wait a second. Reckless Kelly says New York is a bummer too.
The new album from Reckless Kelly is called Bulletproof. Our reviewer Meredith Oakes is a talk show host with Sirius Satellite Radio. If you want to hear the entire song, How Was California? You'll find it at the music section of NPR.org.
Do you remember the game Telephone? You know, the one where you whisper a phrase into the ear of the person sitting next to you, say, fire engines are red. And that person tries to understand what you've said and then passes it on to the next person. And by the time it gets to the last person in the group, it could sound more like, there are bugs in my bed. Well, David Matisiak, a musician living in Omaha, Nebraska, has taken that classic children's game and given it a new twist. In his version of the game, a song is passed around instead of a whisper. Think of it in terms of a musical chain letter. Matisiak emails a sound file of a simple tune to another musician. And that person takes the file and creates his own song out of it. The second musician passes his new song along to a third musician who creates yet another version, and so on. David Matisiak collects all of the versions on his website, telefono.org. David Matisiak joins us from Omaha. Welcome to the program.
Hi, how are you?
I'm well. How did you come up with this project?
After touring in a rock and roll band for about 10 years and being kind of in a situation where you're writing with the same people, collaborating with the same people, I felt like to grow as a musician and grow as an artist, I kind of needed to collaborate with other people. especially with the way the internet's going and everybody has recording software. It just kind of hit me that this might be something that would work out.
But, I mean, you're a musician. Why not just focus on writing your own music?
Sure. For some reason, I'm just one of those people that loves, you know, the team idea, and just kind of collaborating with people makes me a little bit happier than kind of sitting by myself and strumming guitar.
How much leeway do you give people? How much are they allowed to change the song?
They're allowed to change anything or everything, or nothing at all. I've kind of been waiting for that one song to come back where I send it out and then someone passes it on exactly how they heard it, you know, didn't touch anything. But I totally encourage people to chop up the song if they want to remix it, or just add something a little bit here, a little bit there, but total freedom.
We want you to take us through the creative process of the song with the title, Ain't We Superhuman? Okay, you started out by coming up with a riff for this song. All right, this is what it sounded like. Okay, what happened next?
I had actually entitled that song, There Was No Expiration Date on the Carton of Milk That Wore My Thinning Face. And, you know, I just, simple, repetitive, jarring guitar riff. I think it goes on for maybe 2 minutes. It's not that much fun to listen to. I mean, so I sent it to a friend of mine, Bob Nana, who's in Chicago. He just went for it and basically created an entire piece that you'll hear right now. My heart popped and the apology ended. I should have ran up before we began. I could have driven to the river and plunged right in. Now, it sounds almost complete, but it did get passed along, so what happened? The actual file is only about 40 seconds long. It's like a jingle, so to speak. So when he sent it on to a friend of his by the name of Mike Kinsella, who's also in Chicago, Mike added a little bit of color to it. So in this version, you'll hear just a really pretty intro of plucky guitar notes, and he actually extended the song.
Let's hear that. All right, I can hear some of the different elements mixed in there, but that's not the end of it. What happened to the song after that?
So after that, we go to Enrico Molteni, who's an artist in Italy, who I've actually never met. What Enrico did was take the song as he heard it and add kind of a little bit of trumpet, and at the very end, one of my favorite parts in the whole project, he went down to a local beach in Italy and sampled little kids playing and sounds of the waves and crashing and stuff. So if you hear the very end of the song, it, to me, adds the color. It makes it, it's kind of the payoff, if you will.
Oh, what a nice touch to that.
I think
so. And is that the final version?
Right now it is, but that's the fun about this project is, you know, that song kind of got stuck in Italy somewhere. It went on to someone else. I wouldn't want to say it was a language barrier. It was just kind of, it's just stuck right now, but it'll definitely keep going. And from there's no telling where it'll go.
That's David Matysiak, founder of Telefono. This past week, a limited edition box set of 7-inch vinyl records of Telefono songs was released. To hear Telefono songs change as they travel from musician to musician, check out the music section of our website at npr.org. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Leanne Hansen.
From NPR News, it's All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Melissa Block. Jazz in Albuquerque, New Mexico may seem about as likely as a rain shower in that desert city. Well, while rain clouds are rare, jazz is flowing almost every day and night. So for the next story in our series on homegrown music scenes, we take you to Albuquerque. Reporter Paul Ingalls explains how the city's jazz culture was built gig by gig.
It actually did rain today, and the skies are iffy this evening. Charles Lowry knows the audience will come.
Oh, they'll be here. We're not worried about it. They'll get in their cars. They'll be here.
He's not worried because over the course of 15 years, the nonprofit New Mexico Jazz Workshop that he runs has built a solid audience with these weekend outdoor concerts at the Albuquerque History Museum. Tonight's band is Conjunto Colores, a Latin jazz and salsa ensemble from neighboring Colorado. The New Mexico Jazz Workshop began in 1976 as a collective of just 8 musicians in nearby Santa Fe, who realized if they were going to survive as jazz players in the desert, they were going to have to hustle gigs and educate an audience. So they put on summer shows at a small town ball field between Santa Fe and Albuquerque and started a Concerts in the School series. Enter Boston-raised avant-garde saxophonist Tom Guralnick, who briefly held the reins of the workshop in its earlier days, and then returned in 1985 with an idea that would transform the scene.
My idea was, in being here, that I would start another organization that did different kinds of experimental music and world music, and then later jazz. Key to what I wanted to do was to have a small performance space, like some of the places that I'd been to in Europe.
What he settled on was small, a storefront a block south of the legendary Route 66.
This was a print shop. It was owned by 2 brothers, the Furry Brothers, believe it or not. And they built an apartment upstairs for their mother to live in.
Like most jazz musicians, Guralnick wasn't rich. He sold his house to raise the money to buy the place and moved into the upstairs apartment. Below, he created a 90-seat nonprofit listening room, not a club. He called it the Outpost Performance Space.
We set it up as a long, narrow space where people would only be 3 rows from the stage. You know, maybe it wasn't the perfect performance space, but it was what we had.
Over the course of 10 years, with the help of some large grants, Guralnick was able to turn the Outpost into a tour stop for internationally known jazz musicians. The late soprano saxophonist Steve Lacy and trombonist Roswell Rudd played here in 1999. Lacy came to the Outpost a number of times from his home in Paris, and he wasn't alone. Pianist and composer Vijay Iyer, who's on the cover of this month's Downbeat magazine, says the reason is simple. People here come to listen.
Most of these venues, like, you know, if you go to some of the clubs in New York, these are great places to play, but you're always competing with what's on the menu. I mean, if every state in the United States had one venue like this, the entire landscape would be totally different.
The landscape in Albuquerque has been carefully designed to build a supportive audience base. From the beginning of the jazz workshop, education for adults and young people was part of the plan.
So I'll give 2 bars and a downbeat. Ready? Everybody gets a chorus.
Those efforts continue today with classes presented by both the workshop and the Outpost.
One.
One of the products of the Albuquerque scene is 25-year-old bass player Matt Brewer. He went to shows and took classes at the Outpost and started playing professionally when he was 12. Now he's one of Manhattan's most sought-after bassists.
All the bass players in New York that I've spoken with about Albuquerque have been really impressed with their time there. I mean, I think because the audiences are really attentive, shows are often packed full of people, and I think people can tell that the organizations that are bringing shows in are run by people who actually have a passion and love for the music.
It's certainly not to get rich, says the Outpost's Tom Guralnick.
Club owners or nonprofit organizations are not making a lot of money. Musicians are not making a lot of money. And we all support each other. You know, we're all in it for the same reason. And in fact, all of my colleagues, jazz presenters, have been or still are musicians. I would say 90% of them. That's why we got into presenting music, because we believed in the music and know what it's about to be playing music.
The jazz scene thrives in New Mexico because of the steady dedication of each member of the jazz community, says the workshop's Charles Lowry.
To help keep alive the education of young people as well as adults so that they appreciate, understand, and support live music. I think that's precisely why we're in it. We know it has made and continues to make a difference in the lives of people, and it's good work. It's meaningful work.
Because of those efforts, good musicians can keep busy enough to at least pay the mortgage, which is a lot cheaper here than in New York or Los Angeles.
When I moved here, I realized that I could do anything that I wanted to do in the field of music.
Dave Parlato moved here in 1990. He had been a top session bassist in Los Angeles, playing with everyone from Mos Allison to Frank Zappa. But he says in L.A., that's all he was. Here, he not only plays his own music, he also directs the Outpost's education program.
I could wear many more hats here, and it would be okay. I formed a big band here at the old Outpost and had that band for 4 years. I would have never even thought of doing that in Los Angeles.
Parlato says New Mexico's vastness inspires his music. It did the same for jazz legends Herbie Mann, Kenny DeVerne, and Frank Morgan, who all chose to live and play out some of their final years here.
I don't know. New Mexico's a special place.
Outpost director Tom Guralnick.
I mean, it really is. We call it the land of enchantment, which then turns into the land of entrapment, you know? People come here thinking that they're going to stay for a while, and like myself, 30 years later, here I am.
This week, he'll be shuttling between Albuquerque and Santa Fe for concerts in the annual New Mexico Jazz Festival, which runs through July 28th. And features both the best of the local talent and a number of international stars. For NPR News, I'm Paul Ingalls.
At our website, you can hear performances from The Outpost and see a video about jazz in Albuquerque. That's in the music section of NPR.org.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.